This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. The mouth of the mighty Mississippi is closed for business today, and it's unclear when ship traffic will resume. More than 400,000 gallons of fuel oil spilled from a barge when it collided with a tanker early yesterday. About 100 miles of the river are shut down from New Orleans to the Gulf of Mexico. Mark Schlefstein is covering the oil spill for the New Orleans Times-Picayune. And Mark, this collision happened right there in New Orleans. What does it look like? How bad is it?
Well, it certainly is a messy sort of an accident. Fortunately, nobody was injured in this thing. You had a tanker coming downriver, and it basically sliced the barge in half. And as that happened, this huge chunk of oil got released into the river, and it's been sort of spreading downriver ever since. It's a thick, tarry kind of oil that doesn't flow that well.
What's going on with cleanup? Or are they just trying to contain the oil spill at this point?
There's at least four different companies that have been responding to try to capture the oil. So far, they've only been able to capture about 300 barrels as of this morning out of about 9,000 barrels. So that's a pretty small percentage of it. And they've been putting out booms to keep the oil away from sensitive areas.
And there would be a lot of concern, I'm sure, about what the environmental effects would be.
Exactly. Fortunately, this time of year, the migratory birds are not roosting, thank heavens. But the concern is that the oil will get back into the wetlands and will stay on the grasses that are basically the food source for those kinds of birds.
Now, with the Mississippi River shut down, how many vessels are affected by that?
We've counted about 90 so far that are basically either stopped or have been stopped from coming into the mouth of the river. It's quite a difficult situation for the Port of New Orleans. The port estimates that it's losing about $100,000 in revenue a day just to the port itself, and that doesn't include the losses to the terminal operators or the stevedores who work the port or the tugboats and other private businesses that are depending on those goods to come through the port.
Give us a sense of what would be on those vessels that's not getting through New Orleans now.
Sure.
Because of this spill.
To begin with, you've got all sorts of oil products, whether it be large tankers full of crude oil that are moving upriver to refineries, whether it's refined oil that is being moved around to other chemical plants, or oil that is product that's being moved to market. And then you've got all sorts of other goods. You've got both bulk cargo and containerized cargo. Lots of container ships use the port. And then the bulk cargo that we're talking about is anything from coffee coming into this city or grain from the Midwest coming downriver.
And I guess still too soon to tell what the economic impact of this will be.
Right. You know, if this does continue for a couple of days, you might see some problems with some refineries, and that will show up pretty quickly when you see the price of gasoline going up.
We've been talking with reporter Mark Schlefstein of the New Orleans Times-Picayune about the oil spill on the Mississippi River. Mark, thanks so much.
Thank you.
This week, an enormous political football bounced through Washington, D.C., and the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency punted. The question is, will the federal government stand by its mandate for ethanol in the nation's gasoline? Or will it grant Texas a waiver, cutting the amount of ethanol it would need in half? Well, that question has potentially huge economic consequences for corn growers and other farmers, cattlemen and other livestock producers, consumers, environmentalists, motorists, oil companies, international food aid groups, you name it. And here to talk about this question is Margie Criss, energy and environmental correspondent for National Journal. Margie, first of all, the mandate. What does the mandate say?
The mandate was put together by Congress. It was originally done in 2005, and then they boosted it to even higher levels at the end of 2007, saying that you have to blend a certain amount of ethanol in your fuel, in your oil, on a regular basis. And it sort of happens little bit by little bit over time. What this has meant is that the people have been willing to build more and more ethanol plants around the country, and there's been a higher demand for corn.
Price of corn has gone up. People who raise corn have done pretty well. Texas Governor Rick Perry wants a waiver for his state from the mandate. What does that mean?
Well, under the law, it said that states could apply to EPA for a waiver if there was some sort of extraordinary circumstance. He's saying it's charging that because the price of corn has gone up, it's costing more for the livestock industry in his state, chicken growers, cattle growers, hog growers, to feed their animals. And so, therefore, it's costing much, much more for food industry overall.
Because the demand for feed corn has been increased enormously by the use of it for ethanol.
Exactly.
Well, as this question, it's gone to the EPA to decide, and I gather today was the decision day, July 24th.
It was the decision day, but the EPA has come out and said, gee, give us a little bit more time because we've gotten 15,000 comments from various groups. And you can just imagine the corn growers and the food industry and all of the other people that are involved in this just ginning up all of their members to write in.
Well, give us a rough idea of who's on which side here. People who think we should maintain the mandate and keep putting as much ethanol in the gasoline as we possibly can.
Okay, that would be the farmers because they're growing the corn and they're getting more money for it. That's the auto industry because they're putting out cars that take not just a little bit of ethanol, but also some of them will take as much as 85% ethanol in the blend. So they're getting credit for that under the fuel efficiency program the federal government has in place. And, you know, ethanol states tend to be important political states, so those politicians from those states are on Capitol Hill making sure this exists, that
Iowa,
it continues.
Iowa, Minnesota, for example?
Iowa, Minnesota, Indiana, Illinois.
Okay, now those who would be on Rick Perry's side, broadly on Texas's side here, and say we're for a waiver here, let's maybe stop the movement toward ethanol a bit.
Well, that would be obviously the livestock industry. It would be the food industry. Grocery Manufacturers Association has been going crazy because food is costing more, and they're blaming that on corn prices brought up by ethanol use. And also, interestingly enough, the environmental community has been against the larger mandate because they say not all ethanol that's produced is environmentally friendly. It really depends on how you make the electricity that is used to make the ethanol. It's kind of complicated, but what it is basically is if you have a dirty coal-fired power plant that's being used to make the ethanol, then it doesn't do any good for the environment.
Sounds like an incredible brawl involving all sorts of hugely powerful Washington lobbies. But is the final say really with the EPA, or can the Congress overrule whatever the administration does about this?
For the time being, it's with the EPA because there is this allowance in the bill to do a waiver. Just because they might grant the waiver to Texas doesn't mean that they would give it to all the other states. No one else has asked for it at this point, only Texas. But it brings this question up, and it's a political hot potato that Congress will take on, if not this year, then certainly next.
Do we know when EPA is going to announce its decision in this?
Probably in early August. They're talking about that time period. I can imagine when everyone leaves Washington, Congress goes out of session, it would be appropriate time for them to move.
Okay. Margie Criss, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
It's energy and environmental correspondent Margie Criss of the National Journal. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. If you're feeling outdoorsy, thanks to the summer weather, we have some reading recommendations for you. They come from our series, Three Books, where authors pick books that all follow a single theme. Juliette Eilprin is the Washington Post's environmental reporter, and her recommendations are all new and all about the environment.
Despite being a national environmental reporter, I didn't grow up sporting L.L. Bean or going spelunking with my friends. As a result, I often see reading environmental books as homework. But three new books on store shelves this summer eschew both purple prose and hyperbole to challenge the way we view our planet. Bill McKibben is one of journalism's premier commentators on global warming, but in American Earth, he turns back the clock. The anthology collects song lyrics, poetry, political speeches, and essays about nature from two centuries of Americans, from early thinkers like Henry David Thoreau to contemporary writers such as Michael Pollan. Science writer William Stolzenberg takes a more global view of environmental havoc in Where the Wild Things Were. Scientists and researchers who track large animals are the heroes of this story, but the most thrilling moments of the book are reserved for the beasts themselves. In one passage, a pronghorn antelope races against a truck, keeping pace without faltering. It's a beautiful and haunting scene. The antelope is out of place in a world where there are few predators left to chase this magnificent herd. While Stoltenberg examines nature on a sweeping scale, former Time journalist Eric Roston drills down to the atomic heart of the planet in the carbon age. I have avoided anything to do with organic chemistry for years, but Roston's book convinced me that the fastest way to understand everything larger than an atom and smaller than a planet is through the element carbon. Roston writes that our use of carbon to create goods has made us more powerful than plate tectonics when it comes to the potential for destruction. While Hollywood filmmakers expect Armageddon to come from the skies, Roston says we should all look inward. We are the meteor. Reading words printed on dead trees doesn't automatically translate into saving the planet. These three books offer a vision of a different path forward, one that might steer us safely out of the meteor's path.
That was Juliet Eilprin, National Environmental Reporter for The Washington Post. The books she recommended are American Earth by Bill McKibben, Where the Wild Things Were by William Stoltenberg, and The Carbon Age by Eric Roston.
The U.S. Postal Service visits almost every address in the country almost every day. Think about all that stop-and-go driving with gas at record prices. All those gallons funded by the sale of postage stamps. Add up all the costs and you get a keen motivation to innovate, as NPR's Libby Lewis reports.
In Northern Virginia, there's a building that takes up the better part of a city block with no sign.
Hi, Libby. I'm Waldo Tormey, Vice President of Engineering. Welcome to the Engineering Research Development Center.
This is a side of the U.S. Postal Service you've probably never seen. Four floors filled with engineers and technicians whose job it is to tinker and make things better.
And in the basement here, we have our labs.
There are mechanical, electrical, electro-optical, and software engineers working away here like so many elves. They test everything.
We also have labs on the other side over here where we test everything from stamps to repositionable notes to make sure they're sticky enough. We're now down in our automotive technology lab. And over here we have the ethanol vehicle, the E85 vehicle that we have.
Actually, they have 37,000 of them. The Postal Service has the largest fleet of alternative fuel vehicles in the nation. It's using solar cells to power some of its buildings. It's using eco-friendly packaging. It's so hip, it even has a vice president of sustainability. And O'Tormey says this independent federal agency that has the nation's largest vehicle fleet is pushing harder than most to get away from petroleum.
We're exploring all the alternatives in the marketplace for us just to get out of gas consumption. And we know that we owe the environment with 148 million delivery points to come up with the technology that does not impact the environment.
This month, the Postal Service is testing its third hydrogen fuel cell vehicle with General Motors.
We'll test anything. We've tested propane, compressed natural gas, biodiesel, electric. We have electric vehicles in Midtown delivering packages. We will test. And we have plenty of test sites from the Grand Canyon to Alaska.
Renewable energy expert Matt Traum says the Postal Service is being smart about its future.
Let's field a couple of each of these technologies and see what works best for us. And that's the hallmark of really good engineering.
Traum teaches engineering at the University of North Texas.
You build something, you test it, and you find out what was wrong with what you built, and you improve upon it. And that's exactly what the post office is doing.
Back in the Postal Service's automotive lab are a couple of the squat trucks most Americans see in their neighborhood 6 days a week. They're the gas guzzlers. Every time the price of gas goes up a penny, it adds $8 million to the Postal Service's fuel bill. And its fleet of 180,000 petroleum-fueled vehicles is getting older and older. While the Postal Service waits for the technology breakthroughs to help it figure out where to put its money, it's investing in ways to make these gas guzzlers last longer. Walter Tormey says the Postal Service is doing things like cutting out left turns and U-turns.
Left turns, you're usually waiting to make a turn, so you're consuming more gas. U-turns, you're backtracking, so it's a wasted type of trip, and we're finding efficiency improvement of anywhere from 5 to 12%.
More letter carriers are walking more of their routes. They're using bicycles and subways. In the Grand Canyon, they're using mule trains. Otorme says the nation's economy has been built on cheap oil. Now, he says, the U.S. Postal Service, like everybody else, has to change the game. Libby Lewis, NPR News.
One of the latest trends in the auto industry is car makers teaming up with electric companies. It's part of the race for new plug-in versions of hybrid vehicles. And today, General Motors announced a partnership with the Electric Power Research Institute and more than 30 utility companies. From Michigan Radio, Dustin Dwyer reports on what both sides hope to get out of the partnership.
Right now, no major car company builds a vehicle that plugs in for electric power, but in a few years that will change. GM, Toyota, and Nissan all have plans for plug-in vehicles. GM's version is called the Volt. It's expected to go 40 miles on a single charge, and GM engineer Britta Gross says at today's rate, that charge will cost you 80 cents.
At the end of the week, 7 days, you've got a bill of $5.60. That's an enormous incentive to consumers when you compare that to what it would cost to run a vehicle on gasoline today.
That low cost of operation is just one reason GM is moving toward plug-in electric vehicles. But bringing them to market isn't as simple as just building the cars and handing people a power cord. Because in big numbers, these cars will use up a lot of electricity. The good news is power companies do have extra capacity. Mark Duvall is with the Electric Power Research Institute, which is working with GM on plug-ins. He says most power plants have been built to meet the peak demand for electricity, usually during the afternoon in the summertime when everyone is blasting their air conditioning.
So the utilities have to build these big, powerful grid systems simply to handle the few hours a year where we're at peak. And the rest of the time, those assets aren't fully utilized.
So Duvall says plug-ins make good business sense for utility companies, but only if those plug-ins are charged during non-peak hours. That's the hard part. Cars will have to communicate with the grid to determine how much power they need, and the grid will communicate back to determine when and at what rate to supply that power. Duvall says making a smarter grid will cost billions of dollars for utility companies, though he says that's an investment the utilities would make with or without plug-in vehicles. But the car companies are likely to want that investment right away. Plug-ins are expected to be in showrooms 2 years from now. And GM is even hoping that people who drive plug-ins can get a special discount rate on electricity. These vehicles will likely cost several thousand dollars more than standard vehicles, and the company wants as many financial incentives as possible to lure in buyers. But of course, the utilities still need to make money from the electricity they sell, so the interests of the two industries won't always be aligned. Mark Duvall from the electric industry says so far, the collaboration is going smoothly.
The idea is to keep the process as open and as inclusive as possible and make sure that the needs of both parties are being met as we roll out plug-in hybrid vehicles. And there should be no real reason that the two industries should be divided.
But Duvall says he is prepared for some bumps in the road as the two industries work out how to switch cars from gas to electricity. For NPR News, I'm Dustin Dwyer in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Commentator Julie Zicafus rescues birds in distress as a licensed wildlife rehabilitator, and that may seem like a low-tech pastime. Here's her story of what happened when a pair of wrens met one of the most popular high-tech gadgets.
When a cascade of twigs, leaves, and rootlets appeared on the elbow of our downspout, I watched to see a little brown wren trying to make a great wad of nesting material stay on the slippery metal. I caught the bird's eye. "Wait right here. I'm going to help you." I ran to the garage, grabbed a little copper bucket, some wire, and a stepladder. I climbed the ladder, wired the bucket up under the eave, placed the nesting material in the little pail, and climbed down the ladder. The wren perched on the gutter just a few feet away, watching. Before I got the ladder folded, the wren appeared with a bill full of moss and put it in its new home. By nightfall, the nest was nearly complete. Since that day, 5 years ago, 30 or more baby Carolina wrens have been raised in the copper pail, and we've watched the fledglings flutter out time and time again, adding motion and music to our lives. There were 5 nestlings this summer, and they lined up on the downspout before making their first stuttering flights into the world. Well, 4 of them did. When Carolina wrens leave the nest, they don't mess around. One minute, everything's quiet. The next minute, baby birds are shooting out of the nest like popcorn. The parent birds work in shifts, calling and encouraging the young to hop and flutter to the nearest deep cover. Somehow, the adult birds keep them all together and feed them for the next 3 weeks as their wings strengthen and foraging skills develop. So I was alarmed to find one baby wren, all bright eyes and yellow clown lips, still perched by the bucket after its 4 siblings had gained the safety of the woods. Surely a parent would return for it. 1 hour, then 2 went by, and the fledgling was hungry, chirping constantly for help. Oh dear, I did not want to be a teenage wren's mother for the next 3 weeks. I listen, nothing from the silent woods. By now, the family could be hundreds of yards away. What to do? It was time for a little technology. I grabbed my iPod, which is fully loaded with the songs and calls of nearly every North American bird. I ran to the edge of our woods and dialed up the song of the Carolina wren. "Please, please, let this work." I played it at full volume. No response. Desperate, I dialed up the alarm call of the wren and blasted it down into the silent tangle of raspberry and sumac. "Danger, danger," the recording shrilled in wren speak. An adult wren shot right past my head, flying straight toward the forgotten baby in the copper bucket. The recalcitrant fledgling buzzed out to meet it. Baby wren, last seen, headed toward the safety of the woods in the company of a parent. Nature Geek, smiling broadly.
Commentator Julie Zickefoos does whatever she needs to as a licensed wildlife rehabilitator. She lives in Whipple, Ohio.